This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we will discuss a concept or a classic text that we hope will shed light on the world around you. We have with us today Boon Kya Ming, who has taught philosophy and is also an award-winning documentary maker. His award-winning documentary is called MCM Prime.
And last I heard, it's being featured at a film festival in Delhi.
Yeah, the documentary has been nominated for the Jivika Asia Livelihood Documentary Festival in Delhi.
What's the documentary about?
It's about housing and debt issues in Malaysia.
So, you're here to talk to us about Kierkegaard, Søren Kierkegaard, and his philosophy.
Yeah, in fact, the Danish call him Kierkegaard, but we will stick to Kierkegaard.
Because that's how he's known, in the English-speaking world.
Yes. And literally, it means church graveyard, is that correct?
Yeah, churchyard, graveyard, they were, you know, synonymous. And so, yeah, it literally meant graveyard.
Mm-hmm. So, he comes from a family that once worked for the church.
Probably his ancestors.
But, right. Yeah. But he himself was a harsh critic of institutional or organized religion.
That's right. I mean, he died being a staunch someone who attacked the Christendom of his day.
So this is a very different trajectory than when you last came here on the show. You were talking about the politics of space. Mm-hmm. This is, I mean, Kierkegaard is well known as an existentialist thinker. Mm. Reflects on the human condition, the problems of institutionalized religion. It's a bit different than what we talked about before. What inspired you or moved you to talk about Kierkegaard today?
I think Kierkegaard has always been a very interesting thinker. It so happened that this year is the 200th anniversary. He was born in 1813, same year, I think, as... Probably 5 years earlier than Karl Marx. So the people were comparing, they were contemporaries. So, but for me, yeah, it was a journey when I got interested in philosophy. Kierkegaard was one of the first ones who actually tackled philosophy not as an abstract endeavor, but something that you question related to one's own life, one's hopes. You know, when you're looking as a young person, you're looking forward into the future. Kierkegaard poses very interesting questions as to what kind of life should one have, what kind of self you should construct.
I guess when one looks back at history and you think, oh, that time was a time of great tumult, you know, it's the century of Karl Marx and, you know, and the workers' uprisings and, you know, the Paris Commune. Does the history or the politics of Kierkegaard's time impinge on his choices in terms of philosophy, in terms of the kind of themes that he takes up?
The time that he was pursuing his studies in philosophy, I think it came right after the Enlightenment, and Hegel was very prominent in Europe at that time. So he represented a movement which was trying to seek a way to think about existence rather than in terms of systems and logic, which Hegel has basically constructed for Europe. So Kierkegaard was one of the first ones who actually thought that with that kind of philosophy, one is not doing justice with one's lived experience, because we live as human beings moment by moment in temporality. Hegel seems to in a sense, it was a very idealist form of philosophy. Things are put into nice categories, and in fact Kierkegaard attacks Hegel as someone who doesn't give enough justice to one's lived experience in one's life.
And Hegel is, you're referring to Georg Hegel, who's the great systemizer of 19th century. He had a very influential philosophy of history. He had a very influential philosophy of community as well, right? Where he had this interesting theory of recognition, whereby your freedom depends on the recognition of others. And I think Kierkegaard balked at this thought because he felt that this was a gateway to inauthenticity, right? Because he was talking about the rise of mass culture, the rise of democracy, and he saw this as erosions to true individuality.
People would say, what's Kierkegaard's import, right? If you just look at how influential he has been for 20th century philosophy, people like Martin Heidegger, and Jean-Paul Sartre, a lot of people would trace some of their thoughts as coming from, at least the impulse was from Kierkegaard in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Someone even like Ludwig Wittgenstein. I mean, people see him as a logician, someone who studied under Bertrand Russell, but yet he kept copious notes in his journals where he actually saw himself as a Kierkegaardian in many sense, mm-hmm. when it comes to issues of ethics and religious belief.
I think the great dichotomy is between life and system. Sometimes the philosophers, they yield to the temptation of constructing ideal systems about history, about community. Mm. And the common critique is that these systems don't really reflect the human condition in all its complexities and ambiguities. And I think one lasting impact that Kierkegaard has is that he's able to speak to that ambiguity, to speak about the human condition as it unfolds. And that's, I think, that explains the lasting influence he had even in the century after his death.
It's fascinating to hear you make this distinction between systems and lived experience. Yeah, now, is it because philosophers are seeking different answers to kind of very different questions that they choose to kind of cite their analysis on different levels of abstraction, right? So when you talk about lived experience, you really, maybe the language doesn't have to be so rarefied and abstract. You can talk about how you feel or your relationship to somebody, you know, whereas if you're talking about systems, you probably have to even create a vocabulary that makes sense, that will allow you to construct such a system.
Correct. And the statements that make sense of the system must be related coherently to one another. And if there is a chink in that process at any point, then the system is thrown into question. But Sharat, your point on live experience is a good segue into the meat of the text, which is precisely about that.
What is the book that you've brought for us today?
I would like to invite us to consider one of his earlier works called Either Or, A Fragment of Life. That was published in 1843, in the same year which he also published Fear and Trembling, little small text which a lot of people probably would have known him for. But Either Or came a bit earlier than that. But what one crucial point when we talk about Kierkegaard is that the issue of authorship. Because what was interesting about Kierkegaard is that he wrote in many pseudonyms. It was a time where people published not in their real names, you know. And Either Or was actually published as being edited by a person called Victor Eremita, and then it's a collection of varying genres of text. There's a diary in the first part of Either Or. It's called The Seducer's Diary. There's lectures as well. And the second half of it is actually letters by a judge writing to the author of the first part. So I think we need to grapple with the issue of why did Kierkegaard wrote in the form of pseudonyms?
Why did he?
I think one of the major point that he felt the need to write pseudonymously is because he wanted to take the reader seriously as someone who has freedom to judge thoughts for themselves. Because when you have a name and they know your station in life, people usually have certain barriers or certain preconceptions. But because Kierkegaard's interesting way of doing philosophy or writing, as it were, he wants you to invite you to see certain points of view in life. And these points of views could be things that you may not totally agree with. But one should not judge a viewpoint in life without actually immersing oneself in the experience of that life. So by writing in the form of pseudonyms, it breaks down those prejudgments that people tend to have. And it takes seriously the idea that Socrates said that I am a midwife to truth. You know, people have to come to knowledge or understanding for themselves. The truth has to be birthed from their own living experience, not some kind of propositional lesson that, you know, a take-home message. Oh yeah, just regurgitate this and therefore you have received some kind of truth. But so yeah, Kierkegaard wrote as an author who used pseudonyms in order to engage people as free agents, as people who are fully in control of the life choices.
Either Or is a very thick book. Yet, like you said, there are many layers.
The critics of the time they complain that it's a massive volume.
So what are the themes from the book that you want to discuss today?
One entryway into Kierkegaard's work would be to see life, as it were, divided into three stages. The three stages of life that's being popularly known. The first would be the life of the aesthetic. The aesthetic stage of life, where in life a person would live based on immediate pleasure seeking, and you go for what is interesting. We could see that's why in The Seducer's Diary, it records almost like a Don Juan character who goes out to seduce a girl in Copenhagen of that time, and it's not so much of the joy of that seducer gaining the love of the woman. It's more of the enjoyment that this seducer has in his own experience of seducing. So there's constant sort of like reflection on the strategies and the feelings that he get from wooing the woman. It's not so much the woman that he's interested. Mm. It's his own existential experience of being in love.
So he was more drawn to the rush than the proper goal of the process.
That's right.
To the hunt.
To the hunt, correct. Yeah.
That's right.
As they would probably call it in 19th century Copenhagen.
Yeah, that's right. In the 20th century. Mm. It seems to be true even today that people are more drawn to the hunt. It's the journey, not the arrival, right? It's all that. All those clichés. Mm.
But what would... did Kierkegaard talk about why anybody would indulge in that? Why would anybody forego the goal and just stay indulgent in the hunt?
The point that he was trying to show was that... obviously, there are stages in our lives where we would definitely... There are moments in our lives where we live based on pleasure. But he wants to show that that kind of life, at the end of the day, it leads to boredom. A result of just living for the moment is that you are given to whatever mood that seizes you at a time. And then, hence, you will never be satisfied with the experience that you have had. And as you live longer, as you become a 40-year-old, 50-year-old, and your memory is receding, you lose
and your
yourself.
Hairline.
Yeah. Basically, you lose your sense of self. I think one of the key questions that we tackle when we read Kierkegaard's texts is that what kind of self are we confronting? You know, each human being, the Kierkegaard's concept of self is not something pre-given. A self is what you have to construct given the necessities of life, where he actually, in a very short passage, he did define what a self is where you have to synthesize what is finite with the infinite. And we have synthesized freedom with necessity.
So that makes him very much an existentialist, right? This idea of self-construction, that these aren't essential qualities, that you know, that we are in a constant state of being or becoming. I did want to ask just very quickly, this idea of stages, is it a normative type of proposition? Is he saying this is how people ought to move from aesthetic to and to the next stages that you'll describe? Or is it just purely descriptive one? Mm. And if it's descriptive, where does that come from?
It is definitely not normative. As we have mentioned, his mode of authorship is not very... He's not trying to convert you to become... to take up one stage of life rather than the other. He wants us to see from these very vivid characters that he has written about, to see ourselves, as much as is possible, parts of ourselves in these characters. And it's through realization of the kind of self that as in when we confront the self that we see in these characters, we need to make certain choices in response to that kind of depiction of the experiences of those characters.
I think all of us can relate to the aesthetic stage. I mean, it's a sort of an extended adolescence in a way, when you're just going with whatever mood that's prevalent at the time.
Yeah, especially us in our 40s who continue to, despite our receding hairlines and memories, continue to pursue pleasure. Well, that's fascinating, Kiaming. We're going to be talking about the next two stages, which is the ethical and the religious stage, which, as done with the pleasure-seeking stage, the aesthetic stage.
Sorry.
You've been listening to Bun Kya Ming, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and myself, Sharad Kutin, on Night School, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and we're back with Night School. With me is Bun Kya Ming, who's been talking about the work of Soren Kierkegaard. It's quite easy to relate to that idea, mm-hmm. the aesthetic stage. The next one is ethical.
Yeah.
And what does he mean by the ethical stage?
Okay. If you look at the text, the second part of Either Or, a certain person of moral standing in society, Judge William, writes letters to convince the aesthete, the person who lives in the aesthetic stage, that the kind of life you're living is actually meaningless, because you are given to every whim and fancy of the moment. You do not have a life goal. Judge William calls on the aesthete to make a decision to live one's life based on social and moral norms in society. For example, get married, be responsible, grow up, as it were, take up a job. You know, live your life in fulfilling the office, the social station that you are holding to. And that gives you a goal in your life. So the ethical stage is about fulfilling one's obligations to society. But even then, there is some limitations to that kind of existence, because just imagine, you know, do all of us feel motivated to go to work come Monday morning, or you know, we are conflicted as beings in existence, where our moral duties may be compelling, but yet our inclinations might be going the other way. But still, Judge William would say this is a better form of life for you to lead as compared to living just purely for the moment.
So is Kierkegaard describing a tension between community expectations and one's individual will? Is that is that the tension that he's describing?
I think more importantly, he is calling on us to reflect on how we come to choose the kind of life we want, to take our freedom seriously. It's not so much of, he's not, as some people try to paint him as an extreme individualist who doesn't care about social obligations. But what he's against is unthinking, unreflective assumption of one's role in society. Whether it's just blindly going into, you know, in our time would be blindly consuming the products that the TV sells you, the opposite would be blindly following bureaucratic orders just because you are holding a certain office in society. Like politicians, for example, I think they would need a serious dose of Kierkegaard to realize that one can lose the self in trying to project a certain popular persona.
Does the judge have complexity, or is he a kind of, is this a position where I can imagine the voice of somebody, you know, he's the kind of super ego in the story, saying this is what you ought to do, this is duty. He will sound like organized religion and, you know, religious authority or political authority, just sort of telling you this is what you ought to do. Does the judge, in fact, have more than one dimension?
I think he has more humanity in him than just a pure, the voice of society calling on us to back off from pleasure seeking. In many ways, he acts more like a caring father figure who comes alongside a younger person and say, "Hey, I've seen you, you know, wallowing in your pleasure seeking and coming out of it being depressed about it all." The judge would want him to consider for once in life. I think this is the crucial point. The words either or, it comes up in the second part of the book, where when the judge said, I want you to consider, where it's not so much of choosing between good and evil. It's not about choosing one way of life or another. I want you to see that this choice suddenly takes on a significant meaning, a new meaning. That means there is a choice to be made. So I think there is a very subtle shift of seeing that to have a self in modern life is to be able to see the significance in our daily actions, where it's not about, he's not trying, yeah, Kierkegaard is not trying to tell us live this way or take up this position, but to realize that the moments that we live in are infused with potential that will change the rest of your life.
So the point of the ethical is not necessarily community obligation, but a goal outside of your own self-pleasuring, it seems. That was the cycle that A was trapped in. So it was a kind of escape from A's condition, right?
Yeah, A's condition is self-forgetfulness. You know, which is also a problem with philosophers. You know, they like to think abstractly and lose themselves from what is, your life that you're leading, what kind of significance it has in your life. So in the same way, the A in seeking pleasure, he loses that there's something more to self than just living for the moment. And in this sense, Kierkegaard is calling us to consider the potentials that you have as a human being, which we live in a moment by moment existence, but it's infused with infinity. And infinity here means there's a choice that you can make that can drastically transform the direction that you take.
I wonder if this is the point in which we move into the third stage, which is, you said, the religious stage, and how this message is different from the kind of moralizing that happens around pleasure-seeking, right? So people say, don't be indulgent, don't go this way, because, in fact, there's a divine plan that seeks for you to be a father, mother, you know, church leader, whatever, you know. Is the religious stage that which is defined by the organized religion of his time?
I think we need to use the word religious in a very specific sense here, which is a sense of inward passion, where you actually take a leap of faith, which is a famous Kierkegaardian phrase, the leap of faith. It came out actually not from Either Or, but from the next book, which was Fear and Trembling. Either Or actually does not talk much about the religious stage. It's more of the tension between the aesthetic and the ethical. Kierkegaard expounded on what is the religious stage more clearly in Fear and Trembling, where he used the simple story of Abraham. When Abraham hears the voice of God and calls him to go up to the mountain and offer his son as a sacrifice. The point here is that if Abraham followed the norms of society, what he was about to commit is totally unethical. But yet, in the face of something unreasonable, he went on in a very excruciating journey up the mountain. I think this is a very important point, because most religions try to paint their saints, as it were, as finished products, you know, absolute perfect beings. But in Fear and Trembling, Kierkegaard examines the moment-by-moment anguish that Abraham has to journey as he brings his unknowing son up the mountain. And he constantly asks himself, am I doing the right thing? But yet, he took the leap of faith in the face of unreason, that it is this choice that defines him as so-called the father of faith, which is, of course, that's what the Christians in their holy book claims Abraham to be.
So what is this inward passion in the story? Where is it?
In Fear and Trembling, there's a distinction between what he calls the night of infinite resignation as opposed to the night of faith. The night of infinite resignation is usually people who have strong moral impulses, who wants to do good in society. But in many ways, they are torn by, no matter how much good you do, there's always still perfection that is actually much higher than what you are able to achieve. So you're, at the end of the day, you feel you are in despair of that inability to fulfill perfection. But the knight of faith is someone who recognizes that in spite of what you see as impossibilities, you keep on to that commitment, regardless of what society is saying, which in a way Kierkegaard epitomized that in his own lifetime, because he actually spoke out against organized Christianity. He actually talked about Christ as a contemporary, meaning a living example where he challenges you to actually live in a selfless way, day by day, and not as some distant, perfect God, as it were, where people rather worship and not allow that figure to challenge you in terms of your daily ethics and how you should live your life.
So Kierkegaard was a Christian in some sense.
Yeah, yeah. He was very Christian in his disposition, but in many ways he doesn't actually try to proselytize to others why you should take up that position.
I guess he was living in a largely Christian society. I mean, there might have been minorities, Jews and such, but the question is then, okay, so he has a very different view of Christianity than that of the Church of Denmark of his time. And how did this play out? I mean, was it a very difficult message to put out? I mean, did it resonate with people? Was it accepted?
He died an outcast in society. Very sad in a sense. His own brother was a churchman. But even, he died almost, as it were, outside of Christendom. But he was actually given, I think, the last rites by his own family member, I think. But he was considered as someone who was despised by the official church because of his very stringent attacks. He used to say, you know, Christianity as a system of thought is precisely what keeps people from salvation. You know, one has to confront Christ directly in a, what he calls the absolute relationship of God and man.
It seems to me at this religious stage, there is the idea is that one is never complete. One's moral task is always something that you confront on a daily basis. Mm. And it's out of that that you realize your individuality, you realize your own strength. So you don't posit an answer that to solve all conundrums from the beginning. You kind of take on the challenges as they come. Mm. But this is, like you said earlier, something that leads to despair.
Yeah.
Right. In fact, like you said, all the stages lead to despair.
In a way, Kierkegaard leaves it open whether the religious stage will have despair, because he wrote also a lot of pieces on that are almost sermons, as it were. He calls it edifying discourses, which implores the believer to live out one's faith in a very authentic way, which is not, you know, hiding behind social niceties. In many ways, in this sense, Kierkegaard would be a good friend of Nietzsche in the condemnation on the kind of Christendom that was prevalent at the time. If you're more interested in that side of Kierkegaard, you can read his book, The Works of Love, which is basically a genuine challenge on how we can actually embody an ethics of love in our day-to-day existence.
Is Kierkegaard's philosophy something that can be read in a productive way by people within the monotheistic tradition who are not Christian, and beyond that, are people from other religious traditions, or, as with me, I mean, I'm not religious, I'm an atheist. I mean, can I get something from reading Kierkegaard?
A lot of Kierkegaard's best readers tend to be people who are not of the faith. You know, people like Jean-Paul Sartre, Martin Heidegger, who was a priest, but then he became a philosopher.
Slavoj Žižek, more recently.
Yeah, so in that sense, I think the edge in Kierkegaard's philosophy is that that absolute suspicion to any totalitarian thinking, as it were, any easy dogmatism, I think that is something which even atheistic philosophers have gained a great deal from Kierkegaard's writings. Kierkegaard is not someone where you constantly read in a certain stage of a life, but he's always like a companion who comes along your side from time to time in your life to challenge you. Are you taking the question of yourself seriously? And are you waking up to the possibilities of living an authentic life, taking up an authentic cause, for example? Or are you allowing these things to define you, these externalities to define you, or that unique potential that we have as human beings to make free choices? You know, that is what he wants us to confront, and not leave it, you know, in our religious seeking, or in our pleasure seeking, or in fulfilling social demands, whether it's in our jobs or in
our families.
Well,
where do we go from here? I mean, so the book that you suggested was Either Or, and but it's also, you said, can be read together with
Fear and Trembling.
Fear and Trembling. Okay. Sounds fascinating. And you're saying that he's still relevant today? I mean, clearly Jean-Paul Sartre, who comes from the kind of mid-20th century, taking it up, and I can hear echoes of of his from his work. Does Kierkegaard resonance today with contemporary philosophers?
Actually, what's more interesting about Kierkegaard's influence today would be in our films and the popular culture, as it were. I think if you watch films by the Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai, there's a constant theme about one's lived experience, how you confront one's past memory, and is yourself in the past, is it the same person as the one who is existing right now? I think, yeah, films like In the Mood for Love, Chungking Express, I think they are full of resonances with some of Kierkegaardian themes.
That's wonderful. I love Wong Kar-wai.
Yeah,
was that self-conscious? I mean, did Wong Kar-wai read Kierkegaard?
I don't think so.
Okay,
but I think it's the mood of times. I think existentialism precisely was something that it's a lived mood of 20th century.
Because
of the absurdity of, we saw how scientific reasoning can't deliver the kind of rational society that we have, that we hope for, and there's constantly the question of who are we really, what kind of self we are.
Lovely.
Wonderful, yeah.
Okay, so we've come to the end of our show, really. And if you have questions for Kia Ming, you can always post it on our Facebook page. That's BFM Night School.
And you tweet too, right, Kia Ming?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter.
And what's your handle?
Kia Ming, as in KIA underscore MENG.
Okay, so Kia Ming, I too have a Twitter handle. It's at Sharad Kutin, one word. Fuad, shaking his head there. Not yet. He's just resisting. He's the Luddite. So, and you can also write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com, and we'll get your questions out there, and we'll try to answer them at some point in time. Thank you so much, Kia Ming, for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bun Kia Ming. He is a teacher of philosophy, and also has in his pocket an award for a documentary called MCM Prime. You're also listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.